Welcome to the Brown Riot podcast. Hey! This podcast is all about what it takes to be successful in advertising when you're from a different ethnic, cultural, or socio-economic background to the majority. Hey! I'm going to be talking to some awesome creative leaders, as well as a bunch of brilliant planners, MDs and CEOs, getting their viewpoints and experiences about getting in and achieving success in the industry. But whether your skin happens to be brown, black, yellow, pink, green, or any shade in between, these chats are filled with a load of insight and inspiration around creativity that I believe can lead us to a better industry doing better work. So our guest today is a creative director who was born in the Seychelles and grew up all over the place, including the UK, Greece, Middle East and Australia. He moved to Australia in the early 90s and got into creative advertising through that brilliantly old school way, starting in dispatch at Leo Burnett. From there, he's worked at Ogilvy One, Clem's Proximity, also Clemenger BBDO and JWT with some legends. We'll get onto that in a bit. A couple of years ago, he did the Neutral Grain Unstoppable work. He's currently a CD with JWT. He is Will Edwards. Welcome, Will, and thank you for coming on.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start all of these with just hearing a bit about your background, your early life and family background.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in the Seychelles, which, funnily enough, I think it's quite famous as a destination, as a little island in the Indian Ocean. But when I tell people about it, not a lot of people know in Australia. But
it's,
as soon as I say Mauritius,
in the UK, but sure, but over
I
here,
go
maybe
Mauritius,
not.
Seychelles, Maldives, and then they kind of remember. But yeah, I mean, essentially the Seychelles is off the coast of Africa, Indian Ocean, kind of middle of nowhere, tropical paradise, started there. My dad was from the UK, met my mum in the Seychelles.
Right.
And then we moved back to the UK for a bit. We lived in the Channel Islands, where my dad's from. And then we, for some reason, I always like try to come up with a story as to why my dad had to move around so much. I often say he was a drug mule, but it's not true. He moved us around a lot. So we ended up living in Greece. We lived in the Middle East for about 6 years, which was really interesting because we lived in about, I think it was about three or four different countries there. So Qatar, Bahrain, Dubai, Saudi, and just moved around a lot. So
what was going on though? Because I'm a little bit suspicious now. You're phoning that drug mule thing. I think there's a cover.
That all happened after I got in advertising. It's got nothing to do with before. But no, he did a really boring job. He basically worked in telecommunications, got into computers, used to basically run a region. So when we lived in Greece and the Middle East, he was responsible for Africa and also the Middle East region. He'd just fly around to all these countries, set up these massive supercomputers back in the old days. It used to be a floor of supercomputers in an office, and he was just responsible for that. So
you guys would be moving around and you'd be there for a couple of years? The family
The Middle East was 6 years, I think. Greece was only two, and we moved back and forth from there to the UK as well. So we're living in different parts of the UK. We live in Cornwall, Guernsey, Kent as well, London for a bit. So yeah, kind of all over. I mean, we were constantly on the run.
And how do you think all of those different experiences and those different influences of those places, people, accents, inputs have affected your approach to your work, to creativity?
I'm not quite sure how it informs my approach on a daily basis. I do know that, I mean, it was an amazing, amazing childhood, like moving to all these different countries and seeing and being part of these, different cultures. You know, when you think about Greece and you think about all the history and all of that kind of stuff, I was learning about it, but I was surrounded by it. And to me, that kind of sparks your imagination beyond belief. You get to go and explore these places and actually feel what they're like. And I think also as well, growing up in places like the Middle East in this day and age, like people are all just so worried about, the Middle East and what it means and terrorism and all that kind of shit. And I just don't have the same fears as other people, having grown up there. It doesn't worry me. And like, I can see the beauty of that culture in ways that other people can't, the way that, a lot of people would say it's a very sexist society, it's very, it's very unfair, but there's also aspects to it which are really, really interesting. And I think, it's taught me to have a very, very open mind, especially when you're dealing, our job is to kind of think almost, you know, what are our audience thinking and what how are they going to relate to this brand in a way that makes them like it? And so trying to get into other people's heads really helps when you've been around the world and you've actually met so many different people from so many different cultures and so many different backgrounds and, you know, and really understand the kind of the intricacies of those, of you know, where they've come from and why they think a certain way. And that kind of teaches you, you know, there's more than one way to kind of think about things, you know, to approach things.
And how does that, just going back to the Middle East for a second, how does that open-minded way of thinking and being, how does that work with the what I've got in my mind as a stereotypical kind of fundamentalist religious way of being, legal system and society?
Oh, so in terms of the way that they operate, the way that we see them. Yeah. I always thought it was really interesting. I mean, when you think about a society or, you know, a country that's all about religion, like religion is everything to them. You know, if you go to the Middle America, that's kind of true of very many communities there. It's all based on that, and they live by those kind of rules. And so, you know, from a Western point of view, myself being an atheist, you know, raised Roman Catholic, forced to go to church every Sunday, hated it. And the moment I was 18, I said that I'm not going again. To actually be around, you know, an entire country of people who are devout, you know, followers of their religion, that is everything to them.
And but so they must have been so alien to you, to your way of thinking.
Completely. But you see the fact. I mean, and I'm not condoning a lot of this stuff. I'm not. I think a lot of what they. A lot of the interpretation around their religion is wrong, and that's the same with all religions, I think. And that's why I'm an atheist. I don't really believe in any of that stuff. But I can see why they come at things the way they come at things, and the reason why it's taken a lot longer for them to kind of see or embrace change. And I think we'd be the same if all of us went to church and or stopped, you know, twice a day to basically pray. I think we'd be approaching things very, very differently. We'd be thinking about things very, very differently.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a problem with it because I'm atheist like you. I had a Catholic upbringing like you as well, so I that resonates with me. The only thing that didn't resonate was wait until you're 18 to stop going to church. I think it was 14 for me. But
oh, right, yeah.
I've got that. That thing that Richard Dawkins said about there isn't any such thing as a Muslim child, a Muslim baby or a Catholic baby or whatever, but there's just babies, children that are indoctrinated.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And obviously, in a society like that, everyone gets indoctrinated or brought up in that culture and that system.
They do. I, to a certain extent, I think it must have benefits. I mean, you know, there must be benefits to the way that they go about their daily lives to have that sort of level of faith. And I've got, you know, I worked with, the first guy I worked with in advertising is Christian, devout Christian, like born again Christian.
Yeah.
And, you know, he draws strength from his faith. And, you know, I don't have that. I don't have that faith. And so obviously they get something from that. I'm not saying all of it's right. I'm not saying to be raised and indoctrinated that way is right. But certainly having a belief system, I mean, isn't that what a brand has? You know, a set of values that help navigate you through life. I think that is clearly what they get from their religion. And they're just much more into it than a lot of us in the Western world who can pick and choose and decide to go when we want to. And yeah, if the plane's going down, I'm going to pray to God. But, you know, beyond that, I'm just not really interested.
You've just made me sort of imagine the Bible as the brand guidelines of the Catholic Church.
Completely.
I was just thinking, because of all those different experiences that you've talked about and the different places, you would have been a lot of the time the new guy.
Absolutely, yeah.
In some of those environments, and I was just wondering, and clearly you're mixed race as well, your dad and your mum, and you're coming from different places. Did that ever spill over into any racism that you experienced?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's really interesting because until I was 12 years old, well, actually, no, that's not true. Until I was 9, so we moved around a lot. Living in the Middle East, I went to a school full of, you know, kids who you know, from expat families, so we're part of that community. Most of those people came from the UK, but because we're in a foreign country, it's like I didn't experience racism. Even going when I went back to the UK when I was 9, that's the first time I experienced it, and it was like the worst thing I'd ever experienced, because I'd never thought about my skin colour being an issue. I always embraced it as being just normal. It's just part of who you are. And I was surrounded by a lot of kind of brown people in, you know, in the Middle East, and that didn't seem to be an issue, and everybody just kind of went around, you know, about their lives. And
so what happened? Someone in the UK called it out?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember it to this day, because it was like, you have a moment where you go, that's what I should have said, and it's always usually about 2 hours afterwards.
Yeah, I'm normally about a week later. But,
but you know, I was, yeah, I think it was my first day of school, all white school, pretty much. Well,
Where was this? Was this in London?
This was in Guernsey. Channel Islands, just off the coast of France. And some girl came up to me and just said something like, you look like the colour of your shoes, or something like that, in a horrible, horrible way. And I was like, I had nothing. And then kind of the school bell rang, and I went back to class, and I was miserable for about a week.
Yeah,
and I was asking my mum,
and
you know, having parents of mixed race, you know, your dad's white, your mum's coloured, you don't see the issue with it. And you know, I look at them and I go, my dad was a bit of a pioneer back in the day, because when he brought my mum back from the Seychelles, it's like, it just wasn't the thing. It wasn't the, and even back in the 70s and 80s, when we would go back to the UK, it was still taking a while to kind of, you know, people were still getting used to it. So for me, it was a real eye-opening experience. And then we moved to Greece, and again, you know, we're living in Greece, the Mediterranean, we're in an expat community, lots of people from different cultures, different backgrounds. It wasn't an issue. And then I remember this kind of sense of dread moving back to the UK, knowing I was going to live in London. I was also going to move down to Kent after a certain point in time. And I knew that where we were going to end up living, I was going to be the only coloured kid pretty much in the whole school. And myself and my brother, bar, I think there was one guy from Africa who was a lot darker than we were, but that was it, three of us, you know. And it was, yeah, it was really, I suddenly started thinking about it a lot. It's really hard to, when you're a kid, to go through life going, there's this thing in the back of my mind, I feel really uneasy in certain places where I used to, you know, it's like when you see Jaws. That's it, you always feel uneasy going for a swim.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as that thought's in your head, it's very hard to kind of snap yourself out of it. And luckily, coming to Australia, I don't have that concern anymore. I know we're a very racist country. I mean, that's very true of Australia, but I don't have that. I don't feel the same way I do as I did when I had to move back to the UK for a bit. And the racism got pretty bad there when I was a teenager. So through to about 15, some pretty horrible incidents. But, yeah.
It's like that, and I'm sure there were some, you know, we could swap stories about horrible sort of incidents involving physical violence probably, but the one you mentioned, the example you mentioned about the girl saying the thing about the colour of the shoes, just it just hits home, because it's just that feeling of being heartbroken and gutted, and like you say, feeling bad for the whole day. And I think you've talked about you're now here and you're older and things are different, but because I think, I don't know about you, that kind of thing would really hurt me when I was younger. I'd be gutted and upset for days on end and weeks.
Absolutely.
It's kind of water off the duck's back for me now, if anyone has to ever name calling or anything else, just whatever, you know, move past that. But in those days, really, really hurtful. I was just thinking about this the other day, because I remember I saw the Queen film recently. I don't know if you've seen the
Queen.
It's quite good. But when they started out, Freddie, obviously being from an Indian background, they would just be a load of people saying, you know, who's this brown guy? Who's this Paki? Name calling, all the rest of it. And I don't know if this is for real, because this was just the film, but it was just water off a duck's back to Freddie. He would just, only was he brown, but he was flamboyant and just totally styling it out. And I just thought, God, I wish I could have been able to style
absolutely,
out like that in those days.
Well, I mean, you know, you raise a good point. Now we can embrace it because we see it as a positive, but back then it's kind of like, what do you mean it's an issue? What do you mean there's something wrong with it? Well, you know, this was fine 3 minutes ago, and now I feel terrible about it. And you know, as a kid, and you know, kids pick on other kids, but you don't know that at the time. You don't realize that. Like, if your nose was slightly crooked, they'd pick on you. You know, if your ears were too big, they'd pick on you. It just so happens you've got this thing that makes you stand out more than most people. So that's the thing they're going to go for. But it teaches you. I mean, like, I always look at what I can learn from something. It did teach me a bit of resilience and taught me to have in hindsight, you know, to be a little bit more, take life a little bit less seriously, and to be able to laugh at certain things like that. Because I think when you are the only, you know, one of three coloured kids in the school, and especially growing up in the UK, the whole self-deprecating humour kind of comes
into
it. You better
develop something,
you've got to have some of that. So you kind of look at, you know, I wouldn't call them weaknesses, but the things that make you different, you're able to kind of like weigh in on that joke before other people do. And not in a bad way that makes you feel, you know, you're demeaning yourself, but at least, you know, not let it affect you. And I felt that was something I developed quite early, like an ability to sort of laugh at myself and not take myself too seriously, because, you know, otherwise I would have been in tears the whole time.
It's a pretty good life skill, isn't it?
Mm.
And you just talked about Australia being quite a racist country, which it is, you know, in a different way to
the UK
of the 70s and 80s and so on. Oh, it's funnily enough, you just reminded me that about a month ago, I never thought I'd hear this phrase ever again, but a taxi driver actually said to me, "I'm not racist, but..."
And that's
the thing that I grew up with in the UK, in London, in the 80s and 90s, people saying, "I'm not racist, but..."
Mm.
Insert something very racist.
Yeah.
I didn't think that was a thing anymore.
Hate Chinese people. <You
know>? I just didn't think that was a thing anymore. The taxi driver literally said that and then went on to say something racist about Asian people.
I mean, it still happens. The thing is, I look and I go, everyone's capable of making a dumb comment and being racist and being sexist and not, you know, like we pin labels on things. And I think there are outright racist people who you know, are motivated by hate. And then there are people who are really ignorant about other people's cultures. And that kind of brings me back to, you know, growing up in different countries. It sort of taught me, like, to have that kind of open-minded attitude towards people, so that, you know, if somebody cracks a joke, I can go, yeah, it's because you're just ignorant. You just really don't get it. You haven't met a person and sat down with them and actually explored where it is they come from and why they think a certain way. And that's informing your argument right now. If you had more information, if you actually had more experience with it, then you wouldn't be talking like this. So I'll forgive you because you clearly don't know.
Education.
Yeah.
Let's keep that in mind, but let's get on to advertising, right? So we'll get to, I mentioned how you started out and where you started in the dispatch department at Leo Bennett. You pestered your way into a job in the creative department. That, to me, is just such a brilliant classic thing that just used to be a way through. You'd hear about creative directors or CEOs. There was a CEO that worked at Saatchi's in London when I was there who started in the dispatch room. Just awesome, but I don't seem to hear stories like that anymore. Do you think that's just not a thing anymore?
I think so. I mean, look, I think generations have changed. Yeah. You know, my parents instilled in me this kind of crazy sense of you've got to work hard for everything, which I think is still true, and that's, you know, that's the way everyone should be. But I don't think people are all that willing to kind of start on that kind of ground level anymore. They kind of want to go straight in. I mean, a lot of the interns and the people that we get in at agencies now generally come from straight from university, and, you know, they want their career to take off almost as soon as they walk through the door that day. And I think, you know, if you were to say to them, "Hey, you're going to deliver mail for the next 6 months and that's what you're going to do, that's your job," they'd probably laugh and go, "Are you kidding me?" But to me, it was great experience. I was, you know, getting into advertising, I was shit scared. I was, you know, petrified. I was absolutely petrified, because it is such a, you know, you put your pride, you put your, you know, your imagination, everything on the line every day as a creative. And I'd done a couple of creative courses before I got in dispatch, and, you know, I'd present ideas and I'd be shaking because I just cared about what people thought. And I think every creative probably deep down does. We just learn to grow a thick skin. But so for me, I went, okay, I'm not going to just jump straight in. I'm going to go through dispatch and I'm going to get to know the agency and figure out, am I really cut out for this? So for me, it felt like the logical path. And I think a lot of other people, maybe even back then, would have gone, "No way, I'm not doing dispatch." But it taught you everything you need to know about an agency, which is I think what everyone should know, because you don't want to jump straight into a job and then go, "Oh, actually, it's not for me," and then have to go through the process of changing. I was able to kind of, there was a guy in media who's really keen to get me into media, and I walked around, had a look at what the media guys were doing because they were in-house back in the day, and just kind of went, this doesn't feel like the creative department.
Bullet dodged.
No, that's right. And he was like, "Oh, we'll get you out of dispatch early." And I was like, "No, I might stay a bit longer delivering that mail." But it was funny. I mean, like, it just, I gravitated to where the people were having the most fun. And to me, that was the creative department.
But talk me, I mean, it sounds like there was a bit of a master plan in terms of you thinking, right, that's where I want to end up once I've sort of seen how it all works.
Absolutely,
but talk me through
the process
of how you actually, did you latch onto a team? Was there a CD that you're trying to impress?
I did the rounds. I mean, back then, I mean, this Leo Burnett's was pretty big back then. You know, obviously agencies are getting smaller by the day, but I would walk around and I would just, you know, I'd walk in. It was Greg Alder and Paul Figg. I don't know if you know those guys. They're like, they're probably out there still consulting. There was a guy called, who was it? Gary Cunliffe and Andy Firth, who were a DM team. David Foster and this other guy, Greg Logan. I just used to go in and just pester people. Like, I'd drop the mail in and then I'd kind of hang there and, you know, their heads would go back down to what they were doing and I'd still be standing there and I'd just be thumbing through briefs. And then, you know, a lot of the creatives would just give me shit, like, especially this guy, Andy Firth. He was, you know, northerner. He's not with us anymore, sadly, but he was this northerner from the UK, and he'd be like, "Are you still fucking here?" You know, and then throw something at me and say, "Get out." But, you know, half the time you go in there and they'd be like, "We've got this brief for this. Have a crack at it, you know, just see what you come up with." So in my mind, I was doing award school for 6 months. Pretty much every day of the week, and I was getting feedback.
It's intimidating, though, isn't it? Because I remember one of my first jobs, like an internship that I had at McCann's. Those guys, those senior teams who were doing good work, they were like gods. They were doing things that I wanted to do, and they were intimidating. And you know, if they gave you the time of day, I was chatting to a guy who I worked with in those days, Steve Dodds, recently, and he was just such an intimidating character, but for whatever reason, he took a liking to me and took me under his wing and gave me briefs and gave me a steer, looked at my crap ads and, you know, help me. Just really difficult, and it just, like you say, just doesn't seem to happen anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably harder to get people's attention and time now, don't you think? Yeah. I mean, I'm always kind of, you know, it used to be that I had time to see photographers and, you know, musicians when they came in to kind of show their wares, but now it's like, I mean, I don't know, everyone's super busy, I'm sure, but it feels like it's just, you know, especially from, I mean, I tutor at Miami and a couple of other places as well. I've done awards, so I'm always quite keen to kind of help people out however I can, but I'm sure a lot of creatives are just like super time poor now, and you know, don't really have the time to help beyond you know, the 9 to 5 or the 9 to 12 midnight.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, 9 to 5. What agency is that? we didn't quite get to the. So when was the magic moment that you made the leap from dispatch to the first job, or were you sort of one foot in either camp? Or,
no, I was working. So as I was doing the rounds and, you know, badgering people for briefs, I worked on this one charity brief that we had for UNESCO, and it was all about telling people about how we needed to save the oceans. So I, you know, went home, wrote a bunch of scripts, storyboarded them all up because I could draw, came in, and, you know, the creative director was like, right, I want all the teams that are working on this in my office now, I want to see some work. Went in there, presented my work, and he went, right, that's the ad we're going with. And I was like, hey, you said my ad?
What an awesome moment. Yeah.
All these like creative teams were looking at me like, yeah, we hate you now. And so
I got
to work with this guy, David Westgate, who's another kind of advertising legend from back in the day. And he and myself like made this ad. It's the worst ad I've probably ever made, but you know, it had a nice idea to it. We had no money.
It was a TV ad,
it was a great experience, and I went, right, I want to do this. The problem was, I was like quite keen to get out of dispatch as soon as I possibly could. Andy Firth, who was the creative that I was talking about before, he knew a creative director over at Ogilvy 1 at the time, and he said, go see this guy, do some spec work for him, and he might give you a job. And that's how it happened. So I got in that way. It was kind of a bit of a detour. I didn't really want to go into direct, but I went in, and you know, people in direct are lovely. The work was fun, you know, we had a good time. 3 years later, I was like, well, actually, I want to try something more mainstream, because I love the bigger ideas. I love, you know, that the opportunities of that. But yeah, it happened pretty quickly. He gave us a couple of briefs. One of the draw cards was they had The Economist as a client, and I was like, oh great, I get to write Economist ads, that'd be awesome. So we did some ideas for that, and he loved them and hired us on the most measly salary you could imagine.
and because I want to get into talking about diversity a little bit, diversity in the advertising and creative industries for a bit, what was the kind of makeup of the, less the agencies but more the department in those days, the creative departments of those big agencies like the Ogilvy's and the Leo's?
Yeah, I mean, it felt very male heavy for sure. I mean, the agency I work for, there were only four teams, and there were three women in the, actually four in the team. So I felt like, you know, we were quite diverse from that point of view. But in terms of, you know, the agency itself, I mean, it was predominantly, I think I was pretty much the only, you know, person of colour in the agency. And I felt, I mean, Singleton Ogilvy won. I forget the guy's name, but there was an art director there who was, you know, big personality, really lovely guy. But he's the only guy I recognised and thought, okay, so, you know, I'm not the only guy. But, yeah, it seemed predominantly, and like, you know, it still is today, it's predominantly a lot of Brits coming over from the UK and, yeah, you know, that kind of Australian, you know, half Australian, half British kind of skew.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was thinking, chatting to Arvish on one of the other podcasts about a guy that I worked with back at the start, a guy called George Betsius, who was this working class Greek guy, absolute legend, taught me so much, super inspiring, very different from everyone else in the industry at the time. And then there was another guy floating around, I don't know if you know him, Bobby Gassi,
who was kind of crazy
cross-dressing lunatic who just...
Amazing.
Both of them, super talented, and just were going to be them, not for any diversity sake or making up quotas, they just were who they were,
sort of
advertising rock stars.
Yeah.
And that led me on to also thinking about this thing that's gone down at JWT recently. You're in JWT, so you might have heard of this or know about it, the whole thing about the creative director coming in and talking about changing the agency's reputation from a Knightsbridge Boys Club into something more diverse. As I understand it, five Caucasian guys felt a little bit threatened by that, had a chat with HR. They ended up getting made redundant. They're taking JWT to court. There's obviously lots of legal ramifications around that. I don't know. I don't know the ins and outs, but it seemed quite unfair to me that it seems... not unfair is the wrong word, but it seems that diversity shouldn't mean that we're going to get rid of good people because they're not the right colour of skin. It should
absolutely
be.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the thing. And maybe it's just because of the experiences I've had, but I always think it's the best person for the job, you know. And I don't really know the intricacies of that situation over at JWT London. Like, it sounds like a complete mess, and I wasn't privy to any of those conversations. Sure. I don't know why those guys felt threatened in the first place, because I don't think that's necessarily something to feel threatened by. I don't think it's necessary to go out and say, right, we need to balance the creative department up in a certain way because this is lacking. It should be about talented people who bring the right expertise to the table and the right expertise for that client that they're working on, you know. And that to me is the most important thing. I don't think those guys probably should feel threatened by having more gay people in the department. I mean, why would that be an issue? I certainly don't give a stuff about that. But on the other hand, I don't think maybe, you know, the fact that they have an issue with it should be a reason for dismissal. But again, I don't really know the story properly.
No, totally.
So I probably shouldn't talk about that. But I do think it's a mistake to say we need more people like this, or we need more people like this. It's like, what are we lacking in? Okay, so we need somebody who really gets the ins and outs of Nestle, somebody who can deliver really funny, witty, you know, ideas for this client, because that's what's required. We need a young team who get it, you know, as opposed to, you know, this client who's a lot more serious and probably needs somebody who's kind of got a financial back. You know, that's what it should. Yeah. That's what the discussion should be about.
I would have, like a month ago or a couple of months ago, I probably would have agreed with you. But my mind's been slightly swayed by chatting to a few guests on this very podcast over the last few sessions, and people talking about the need to just level the playing field. We're coming from such an unlevel place where there is very vanilla, it's very generic, there's very few people of colour, and the gender balance is very out of whack, all of those things. It started to feel to me, the more I think about it, that there needs to be some kind of correction. That correction obviously shouldn't be done in an unfair way, but it does feel like somehow we have to change that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree and I kind of disagree as well, because I can't, it gets to the point where you start going, well, what are we lacking in, because we don't have enough.
We haven't ticked that box.
You know, we haven't ticked that box. We don't have enough, you know, short, gay, brown, you
vegetarian.
Know, vegetarian, yeah, vegans who, you know, like, to me, it's just that seems like, well, you know, who are we trying to please? I do feel the gender imbalance is super, super important that we fix, because I think, you know, there are many briefs I worked on where I've gone, and maybe this is me, and this is I think, you know, women should be able to work on briefs that target, you know, like products that target men, and vice versa. You know, it comes down to your creativity and your ability to, you know, empathize with your audience and all of that kind of stuff. But I also think that there are certain briefs that I'm just not going to be able to tackle in a certain way. And I think that makes more sense for, you know, the right person to be able to tackle that. And I'm very open to that. And I think creative departments have been, you know, run by blokes, and predominantly, you know, it's been all white blokey department. And I think that definitely needs to change. But to what degree? To the point where we're going, oh, we're excluding somebody who could be freaking amazing, he's amazingly talented, but now he doesn't tick a box because we've taken away that box, you know?
I mean, to what degree? And also for me, like, how do we bring about change in a gnarly kind of argumentative way, or in a way that's kind of good for everyone? So I've got a little quote here from the strategy director of BBH in London, a lady called Imali Hitarachi. She recently wrote this really good article called Dear White Men, We Need You. I don't know if you've read it. I'll ping it to you. But she's talking about how in the whole process of balancing up gender or cultures or ethnicities or whatever it is, it doesn't have to be an anti-white males or an anti-anything. So this little quote I'll read out, she says, from a personal perspective, a number of white men have been instrumental in my career. White men have hired me, reassured me, mentored me, pushed me, promoted me, and I know firsthand that there are lots of other diverse people who have had the same experience. In our industry, there are many empathetic white men who are using their power to further this diversity agenda. Are we talking about that point enough? So we're all on the same side, I suppose, is what she's saying, and what I believe. I do think there needs to be some kind of change. Just how we go about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, my dad's from the UK, my mum's from the Seychelles. So I've never, you know, I've always looked at it as being it should be fair. It should always be fair. I think people like myself and yourself have the ability to change the way that a department is structured if we feel like it's lacking a little bit of this. You know, we're all, I always look at it and I go, I feel like we need, you know, my department is pretty damn small probably compared to yours, but, you know, I want to make sure that the balance is right. We've got enough women, like talented women, working for us, and actually, if anything, we've got more women working for us than we do guys, which is fantastic. But I never really look at that and go, oh, we've got to get the balance right now. Like I'm never looking at the balance. I'm always going, does it feel like a vibrant creative department or a vibrant agency? Do we feel like we're, you know, complementing each other in terms of strengths and personalities? And it's all about the right fit, I think. You know, if you're going to grow culture in a place, it's all about getting the right people in there and making sure that they're what they bring from a personality point of view and from an expertise point of view, of course, is going to make that kind of a richer experience. And I just, you know, I never really, and maybe it's just me, I'm not looking at colour and I'm not looking at gender. I'm just going, do I like you? Are you a good person? Yeah. Are you a great creative? Are you going to make this department a happier place? Because, you know, I don't hire based on talent alone. I want that person to bring something from a personality point of view as well, to, you know, brighten people's days and be fun to work with, not a prima donna and, you know, somebody who chucks their toys out of the pram every time someone says no, you know. So that's what I'm looking for.
That's awesome. That's inspiring, because I'm torn. I'm super torn, because on one hand I'm on this big, we need more brown people, brown right, all of, you know, this podcast, all I'm all for that, but I love your approach of just kind of not really seeing colour. It sort of reminds me of my kids. One of my sons goes to Paddington Public School, and that school is just so mixed, the different ethnicities and the mixed races and the Asian this and whatever. And I genuinely don't think my 9-year-old ever thinks that there is such a thing as colour. He just wouldn't really think that he's a different colour, because everyone's everything and it's just not a thing. And he, like yourself, just judges on who's fun to play with in the playground, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. No, that's a wonderful way to be. My kids go to a school, well, they both went to the same primary school, and it's the same thing. It is so multicultural, it's fantastic. And they've never questioned me about racism. And I'm sure it's going to be something that comes up in the future. I mean, they're kind of a mix as well. Their mother's from Croatia, so... You know, they've got olive skin. They tan up in the summer and they go kind of pasty white in the winter. So it's like for them, they don't even think about it, and I think that's fantastic. But I was just going to say, you know, the thing that sticks out to me is less around, you know, creative departments and, you know, media departments, because we've got in-house media as well, or even account service for that reason. But for the same reason, but it's more management, like senior management, being part of you know, a big kind of holding company like WPP. For me, I would like to see a bit more of that up in that kind of
area. A bit more diversity.
Because I think it kind of all trickles down, doesn't it? Like, the diversity should come if you've got enough people in place. And our CFO is, you know, he's from India, and, you know, he's but he's probably one of about, you know, 20-odd bods up there that I go, oh, okay, well, maybe we need a bit more diversity up there, because that's going to inform everything that comes, yeah, you know, that trickles down to the agencies. I certainly feel like that would help in their decision-making as well.
So, just going back to your career in general, you've obviously worked with a bunch of legends over some of those different jobs. People like Danny Searle, Rocky Ranallo, Spurco, Paul Nagy. What lessons have you gleaned from those different personalities? Really talented bunch of people there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, like, all amazing people. I mean, I throw Richard Maddox in there as well. He was an amazing guy to work for. Mark Collis. I mean, they're all just... Mike Miller was another one. They're also just, like, amazingly different people. You know, they all had very, very different styles of being a CD. You know, some were, like, you know, very, very kind of... you know, expressive and talkative, and then others were kind of more reserved and quiet, but, you know, like, always thinking about the work and ways to improve it. But, you know, the guys that I gravitate towards are always the ones who have a sense of fun, who kind of, you know, remind you on a daily basis that we love what we do, but let's not take it too seriously. You know, it is advertising. As people say, we're not curing cancer and all that kind of stuff. And that's so very true. I mean, people like Richard Maddox, you know, when he came over from Colenso, to me, I mean, he just had this kind of crazy, kind of wacky approach to everything, and I think that was infectious, because it starts with, you know, that senior figure in creative. You know, we're all looking to our leaders for leadership, and how are we going to behave, and how are we going to go into meetings, and how are we going to show up? Are we going to show up and tell the client how it's going to be, or are we going to walk in there with our kind of tail between our legs and go, oh, do you like this? You know, and I love, you know, for me, it was the guys who walked in there and weren't afraid to be themselves and just had a laugh every day, and sort of, you know, it was all about coming up with great ideas and making, you know, the work as great as it possibly could be. Rocky Ranallo was another one, very, very different to Richard in terms of, like, a lot quieter, but, you know, and so really, so very humble as well. Like, had won so many awards, done so much great work, and yet kind of just felt like, you know, a friend. And I love creative directors like that, where there's not this divide. They're on your side. They want the best for you. They just want to see your work, you know, improve, or they just want to help you get good ideas up and make them. And I think that's what we're in the business of doing. You know, the more we make, the more motivated we are to do better. And, you know, if that comes from a creative director and his style, I think that's probably the thing that drives culture in an agency as well. I always think the work drives the culture.
Yeah. It's funny, just a sidebar going back to Rocky, because Rocky taught me at award school and was awesome. Like you say, super talented, humble, all of those things are amazing. His son, Joe Ranallo, is in my department now. Also super talented, not quite as humble as Joe. He's, you know... he's a very, very talented fella.
Yeah.
You were making me think that there were two things that you were making me think as you were talking. One is that I think all of those things, like you say, when you look to your leaders for lessons, for ways to be, for culture that goes through the department, totally agree with all of those things. But I also think I've learned as much from the creative directors I've had who I didn't like or didn't rate, who I thought were doing it wrong.
Sure.
I kind of start to look at those guys and think,
yeah,
I wouldn't have done it like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
What did you say that for? And just putting those into your locker and thinking, okay, I'm not going to do it that way.
Yeah,
it's been quite helpful to me.
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen, as you have, so many different styles. I mean, you know, creative directors who would not give you any direction, or kind of, you know, you walk out of there feeling really confused. And I think, you know, sometimes maybe it was them not really knowing what the solution was and sort of throwing it back at you. And then other creative directors who would be like, you know, it's your job, you solve it. I'm not going to give you the answer on purpose because I want you to kind of, you know, that's your job and I'm giving you that responsibility. So the ones I always had I kind of felt we're doing it wrong with the ones who created that divide between them and the creatives, you know, like I'm the creative director and you're here. And sometimes, you know, maybe they've read a book about leadership that I haven't, but I honestly think you get more out of people when you're, you know, when they see that you genuinely want the best for them and you're on their side. You're on, you know, not exactly on their level because you have to be a leader, but, you know, you're there with them and you're experiencing their problems and listening, you know, basically listening and trying to help them out, because it's a pretty tough industry when you think about it. You know, we go through a lot of pain every day coming up with ideas, seeing them die, or pushing an idea through only to see it get diluted and stuff like that. And I think if you're working with people who irritate you or make you, you know, not want to come to work, then that's you know, taking the joy out of it.
Yeah, I also think though on that I'm a big boxing fan. There's a saying in boxing that styles make fights, and I think it's the same for creative directors and departments. Yeah. There's a guy that I worked for in London, a guy called John Pallant at Saatchi's, who I think half the people that worked for him thought he was the most inspiring dude ever, right, including me, and half the people just thought he was a nightmare. Yeah. And that was because he had a very sort of intense and laid back at the same time. So you'd review with him and he wouldn't give you a lot. Super smart guy. He wouldn't give you a lot. He'd often just say, keep going.
Yeah.
And some people would come away from those reviews just pulling their hair out to go, oh, fuck, don't know what to do. Yeah. He's given me nothing. I just kind of come away from there thinking, got to try harder.
Yeah.
Got to keep pushing.
Absolutely.
I remember I wrote a script, and this must have been about round 7 or 8 on some brief that I was working on. And I don't think he even bought the script, but he just cracked a smile. He cracked a smile. Maybe there's a little giggle. And and that for me was almost better than winning any award. Just I made John Pallant, I don't know if it was a laugh, that's maybe too much, but I made John Pallant smile. And that was just, that was gold to me. Let's talk a bit about your career, a bit more about your career, sure, and some highlights. So I mentioned at the start the unstoppable work for Nutri-Grain. Should we talk about that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, look, that's kind of a recent campaign I worked on, and I think what I liked about that was, I mean, you know, it's for a cereal brand. It's a very, very tough brand to kind of work on if you want to get something, you know, award worthy out of it. I mean, you know, they've very, very kind of set ways of doing things. Lovely, lovely client. I'm saying that not because I'm afraid of them hearing this, but they genuinely were a lovely client. But they have processes they follow that come from America, and you know, we kind of tried to get them to a certain point, and it took a really long time. And I've always had this point of view, and maybe it's because I've been doing this a long time, that you know, advertising is about relationships and it's about building trust, right? So it's like, if you don't have that, you can be the best creative in the world, you're not going to get anything made, and you're just going to piss a lot of people off. And for me, I don't mind doing a bit of groundwork and waiting a while to get something good up, because if it's great as opposed to a bunch of just okay stuff, it was worth the effort, it was worth the wait. And so with them, it was kind of a few years in the making. I mean, we were working on other clients, but it was a few years in the making. And then we got to this point, we sold this in, we had a very brave CMO who ended up, him and the MD ended up getting fired, not just because of that campaign, but because of they became risk takers. They took a few risks, and that got passed up to Global, and Global went, what the fuck are you doing? You know, like, you don't do good work, you just, you know, just do this, just do, you know, less risky work. So for that reason, you know, we had a brave client, we put this idea on the table, we're not going to put any cereal in the spots, you know, they're going to be 12 minutes long. I know, you know, digital are telling you it needs to be 90 seconds because, no, you know,
let's get the logo up in the first 2 seconds.
This
as
like,
well, come
you know,
on.
Here's the rule book on how to do advertising.
And
we're like,
shot.
We're going to break every rule. And, you know, everything gets researched as well at Kellogg. So we went through rounds of research and we came out the other end with a bunch of really inspirational stories. But the experience for me as well, I mean, it's funny, I learn it's uncanny. I almost learn something from every campaign I work on, because you inject a bit of yourself into that, and it's like, oh, okay, so it's all about believing in yourself. It's all about overcoming, you know, massive odds. It's kind of what we do every day, you know, and it's about, and that's kind of a life's lesson as well. And I met these, you know, a blind surfer who's been blind since birth, who has surfed Pipeline and, you know, it just done amazing things. And just, it's like, to him, nothing's a hurdle, nothing's, you know, an issue. He just gets on with life and he does amazing things. And it kind of taught me a lot just meeting somebody like that. And then meeting a guy who had the worst experience of his life, paraplegic, you know, went to jail for a couple of years. That's the other amazing thing. Nutrigrain went, yeah, yeah, sure, we'll talk about somebody who went to jail for a couple of years for dealing MDMA. You know, yeah, that's fine. And then, you know, had this accident when he was coming back as potentially one of the best FMX riders in Australia. And then meeting this guy and showing him his story and sitting next to him as he cried, like we showed him in a cinema, like a little cinema complex, and he was in tears. I saw him shaking, like when he watched his own story play back to him, because A, it was so inspirational, and B, he basically had his whole, all of that pain just brought back to him in that moment, stuff that probably he'd been pushing down. And for me, it was just an incredible moment to sit with this guy and go, you're an incredible dude, and you know, your story is amazing, and I feel your pain, and I don't even, you know, I get up every day and I take it for granted that I can get up and just walk around. This guy is in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, and you know, had the guts to come and tell us his story and be part of this experience. And you know, that guy's still struggling every day, I'm sure, but it taught me something a lot about myself. And just, you know, just don't get so worked up about little things. Get on with it. Just get on with it and do it, you know.
Super inspiring, right? And awesome to be able to get it onto the screen sort of fairly untouched and not,
absolutely, yeah,
you know, watered down and diluted and compromised and all of those things.
Completely.
And you talked about building trust as a way to get that work done. I'm totally with you on that. I've got this thing that you can't sell brave work and you can't sell bold work to strangers. Mm. You just can't, because by its very nature, that kind of work is going to take the trust of two people, you and that guy who's going to, yeah, or the person who's going to buy it. And if they don't know you, how are they going to buy that?
Absolutely.
So how long did it take you from, you know, for building that relationship, for having those ideas, for, you know, doing other work on,
yeah,
that brand?
I mean, Kellogg's, you know, nothing happens quickly. It's FMCG, so they do a lot of testing. So you can imagine, probably from your experience as well, it can be anywhere between 6 to 9 months to get a campaign up. And the interesting thing as well was the Andy story. Even though we got it made, somebody in America said, like, absolutely not, you're not running that, because of, you know, the fact that he went to jail for drugs. So that got the probably the most inspirational story, the most emotionally touching story, got taken off the table, which was heartbreaking. But we found ways to kind of go through the network and get it sold back in, and then actually run. So I mean, it was to actually get the whole campaign run was probably a year and a half,
yeah,
which is a lot of effort, a lot of persistence, you know, working with a lot of talented people on the way who were obviously gutted about every kind of little obstacle that came up. I mean, we were having conversations about, right, it's a great 13-minute film. Can you cut 7 minutes out of it? And you go, no, no. And, you know, having those kind of constant fights, but then going, I just sat next to a guy who cried watching his, you know, his story play back to him. I can do it. Suck it up. Just yeah, keep fighting on. Make it happen. But yeah, to build that relationship with a client probably took about 2 years overall, like to get to that point, and then to actually sell the work in and get it made was another year and a half. So yeah, you know, it was a while. But I've always done that. I mean, like being group head at Clem's, always had clients for a while. Like Campbell's was the same thing. It took a while to get an ad up for them that they really loved, and then once you get that gold up and, you know, they trust you, you can achieve great things. I've seen it happen with other teams in other agencies as well.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah. Just hearing that story and the sort of the time it took to make that work, it's fascinating to me, because the actual time of coming up with that idea for those films and the actual time of making those films, shooting the films and crafting the films and all of those things is a fraction of the process, is a fraction of the 2 years. And I don't know how you feel, but I feel as a creative director, the rest of it is as much a part of the job as it is having the idea and making the job. It's kind of creating the conditions, yeah, and building that trust, like we've been saying, to get it out there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's not a skill that everyone's got, because people come in as a creative person. You come in as a creative person to do work, to come up with ideas and all of that. And not everyone has got those naturally gregarious or extrovert personalities or whatever you need to build that trust. How have you found that side of things as you've gone through your career, that side of earning people's trust and being able to get into those situations?
Oh, well, I mean, look, it's... And probably everyone's had this experience. I mean, I started out thinking it's just about ideas, and then walked into probably my first, second, third presentation going, crap, I've got to, you know, relate to this person across the table who just said something really odd and I don't know why. And for me, it's like I put a huge amount of energy and effort into really understanding what makes people tick. And again, this probably goes back to, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people do it, but, you know, growing up overseas, like, just why does somebody think that way, and why does somebody behave like that, and why is that really important to that person? And it's amazing once you understand, because I mean, people are communicating with words, but they're not really saying what they mean most of the time in a boardroom. And like, I, you know, to be able to understand somebody's body language, their little mannerisms, that when they say this, actually they mean this, it means everything. Because you can, first of all, you've got to sound like you're listening. I mean, you've got to appear to be listening. And once a client feels like you're listening, you don't necessarily have to, I guess, you know, take everything they've said on board. You have to just try and unpick it and then go, actually, you know, all we need to really do is this, and this is going to win them over. And so, like, really understanding clients, and it's hard as well because they jump in and out and they change all the time, but really understanding clients, I think, is fundamental to what we do. Because if you don't understand them, then the process is going to be 3-4 times as hard, and you're just going to be butting heads. So for me, the last 6 to 7 years, maybe, yeah, I mean, it probably started at Clem's, I realized that my life was a whole lot easier when I paid attention to the people in the room and really understood what made them tick. And some clients, you're just never going to get something good through. They're motivated by different things, and maybe it's we're not answering a business problem that they understand, but they haven't communicated. But a lot of the clients that I've, you know, developed decent relationships with, you can have a conversation with them. You can present one director or one script or whatever, and they'll take your recommendation on. Boom, done. And that relationship is so much more fun when you have that relationship with a client where they trust you, and you walk into a meeting and you're not just waffling and giving them ad speak. You're actually having an honest conversation, and you're using everyday language to kind of say, all right, so this is what you want, and this is how we're approaching it, and I think we're aligned, but you're not getting this part of it, and that's really, really important, and, you know, so on and so forth. I feel like I sit in boardrooms a lot and just hear a lot of advertising jargon spouted across tables, and it's no wonder clients don't really trust us, because we use all these words and we don't really have honest conversations. It's funny, I've never seen myself as a polished presenter. I've never seen myself as a, you know, a really great kind of people person. Like, I've always been very shy and introverted. But, you know, I've kind of pushed myself to just embrace that kind of imperfection and just go, okay, I am what I am. If clients like me, great. And I've found that that's actually worked. The less polished I was and the more honest I was in meetings, the more clients gravitate towards you and feel like you've kind of broken that wall down. They can actually have a conversation with you about something they're worried about. And then you can sort of say, I know it's a concern, but this is how we're addressing it, and don't worry. Yeah. As opposed to some clients that will go, I don't trust you, just do this, you know, which is the worst thing that you can have.
I mean, as you say, it all comes down to understanding clients, or probably even more than understanding clients, understanding human psychology, I guess, is what the boardroom's about.
Yeah.
It makes me think of, I don't know if you're a Mad Men fan, but Don Draper. I love a couple of things I love about him. Firstly, I don't know if you ever saw the one where how he started off being a fur coat salesman. So he kind of had no background in advertising. He's basically a blagger at the end of the day. Yeah. He's this coat salesman who blags his way into an ad agency because he meets Roger Sterling. And I love the fact that he's completely blagging it. And all the way through, really, his ads are pretty crap. He's a pretty terrible creative director or creative anyway. But he just understands human psychology because he's got that background in selling. Kind of understanding body language
and what
people want.
Yeah, exactly. And knowing what's important to them, you know, the way he sold the, what do they call it? It was like a
Carousel. The way he sold that. I looked at that. Yeah. I was just mesmerized by it. I'm like, you're a legend. I did like the way that they he weighed in on the Volkswagen advertising. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
I thought that was genius. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it is. It really is about. I think everybody comes at it from different angles. For a while, it was very much about me. I'm selling an idea. It's all about me. It's all about my idea. It's all about being liked and having my idea liked and sold so I can go make it. And, you know, and over time it became less about that. And it was more about I can divorce myself from what we're trying to do here, because I realize that's the right thing for this brief. And the client's going to see it slightly differently. It's amazing how you can say something once in a meeting and think that the client's understood it, and they completely misunderstood what you've said. And it's not until they see the finished product that they go, oh, so that's what you mean. And it just, it blows my mind that, you know, we probably take a lot of things for granted in the, you know, we work in communication, and yet we probably don't communicate our ideas in a way that clients or understand straight away, because they haven't got the same brains as us. They don't come at it from the same point of view. Yeah. So we're talking about art, creativity, and they're like, well, I don't care about that. I'm sales, you know, engagement, brand recognition, all that kind of stuff.
I'm a big fan of those really sort of idiot-proof self-presenting decks that you put together that when you're not in the room, and they get sent around the client organisations, totally, you know, you don't need to leave anything to the imagination.
Yeah.
Big fan of that.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Australian advertising for a little bit, current state of Australian advertising. I spent a chunk of time in the States recently, and just fascinated seeing all the American advertising. And I don't mean, you get a very different experience going to Cannes or judging awards or looking at award books or whatever than you do spending time in a place and just flicking the telly on or driving past billboards and seeing the standard of everyday advertising, not the cream. And I really enjoy the directness of American advertising. I love the silly medical ads with all the crazy terms and conditions and the crazy shouty retail stuff.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the standard of work here in Australia? And I mean, I don't mean the work that wins awards and all these big famous Lion winning work. I mean, when you're watching MasterChef and the ads,
the general standard.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you've probably had this experience as well, but coming from the UK, the first thing you notice when you put the TV on is
the shouty ads.
The ads are terrible. And I felt, you know, I mean, it's, you know, because we work in the industry, we're more aware of the good stuff. And I think if you go to New Zealand, which, you know, pumps out a lot of great work, if you go and put the TV on, there's the same percentage of crap ads on the TV there as well. Probably the same in the UK, but I did notice there are fewer great ads and maybe fewer great brands
here
in Australia. Yep. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's been something that's, I've been here for 25 odd years. It's been the same since I got here. So, the gold doesn't, you know, there's not as much great stuff as there is probably overseas. But I think there are a lot more hoops to jump through here. I mean, we research a lot. So
Smaller budgets.
I mean, obviously in New Zealand they don't research. So, you know, they probably spend that research budget on just, you know, if the ad fails, let's just do another one, you know, and let's get something else out there, which I think is probably a better approach. But I do feel like we do play it safe a lot more in Australia than we probably should. I do get that sense that clients are afraid to make a move. Maybe a lot of the brands I work on as well, because I don't think this is just an agency thing. Agencies are keen to do great work. We're always pushing great ideas. I think maybe on the client side of things, they're looking to other markets and they're going, well, I like this. Or, you know, we're a global brand and global are telling us to behave like this, so we have to pass that on to our agency. And so they're a lot more risk averse. And I think lately I've noticed a lot of far fewer, you know, pieces of work that kind of stand out for me as, you know, great bits of advertising. Overall, I don't expect to see something good on TV when the ad break comes on.
Yeah, I mean, my take, I've got a theory on that, having sort of worked in London and here. I found the clients in London are generally just a bit bolder and a bit more ambitious, because they're all on their way to the top, trying to climb the greasy pole, and they want to get a big job in New York. Make me famous, Ant, because I want to get that job in New York. Over here, it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful country. Mm. People's kids are in expensive private schools, and it's more, don't rock the boat. Don't do anything that's going to get me fired.
Part of it. I mean, somebody was saying to me recently, just like, everyone's mortgaged up to the eyeballs at the moment. Everyone's afraid of losing their jobs.
Don't be a hero.
Just don't be a hero. Play it safe, you know. Just get the job done. Don't stick your neck out. And I think that's kind of, you know, there's been a ripple effect, and that's affected probably more than our industry. But I think, people are very risk averse at the moment.
What about when you do turn that TV on, you flick it on, you're watching MasterChef or Australian Ninja, as my kids do, or whatever it is, in terms of the makeup of casting? Because we've talked about the makeup of agencies and departments that we've built. Do you feel there's a good representation of the different multiculturalism of Australia?
I think it's still very much token. I mean, I'm working on Vodafone a lot at the moment, and they've really embraced the whole multicultural thing, which, I it's a surprise to me that we're even talking about it. But, you know, I've had clients who have outright told me, no, we're not putting brown people in our ads, you know, like, and forgot that I was the only brown person in the room.
Recently? Or?
No. This was probably about 7 or 8 years ago. I won't name names. But, you know, like, it was, and back then I was kind of like, I roll my eyes because I'm used to it. I've seen that happen before.
Brown people don't resonate with our target audience.
Yeah, exactly. But put an Asian person in the ad because there are more Asians. There are more Asians in Sydney that, you know, have more money or whatever. You know, the kind of stuff you hear across the boardroom table, you go, oh, okay, yeah, well, whatever. But I definitely think there was an ad for, I forget who it was for. I don't know if it was Office Works or something like that, but they had this, I don't even know how to describe him. I don't even know where he was from. Like, he was, you know, potentially Indian spokesperson, you know, Australian accent. And just the very fact that he was walking, talking to camera, it's the first time I've ever seen that in Australia. I just went, that's so ballsy. And it just makes me like the brand straight away. And, you know, obviously I'm biased, but I saw that and I was just like, that is so cool. Now tell me what you've got to say, you know, and I'll listen to it. And I just thought, you know, that there is through casting, through, you know, putting really, you know, making kind of more interesting choices, by putting the right kind of people in your ads, you know, more than just your you know, blonde hair, blue eyed, you know, white family. I think you've got a chance to really disarm people and be different, and get people's attention. I definitely think it's an opportunity missed if clients aren't seeing the value of that.
Do you think it's quite polarising, though? I'm just thinking of that in particular. There would probably have been some people who were turned off by that and don't, you know, that kind of person doesn't resonate with them. Who knows?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, I mean, you know, we live in a bit of a bubble, because we, you know, we all probably live either on the North Shore or the Eastern Suburbs or the Inner West. You know, a few of us live out in the Western Suburbs and beyond. So I'm sure that's kind of in the minds of a lot of our clients when they're thinking about, yeah, but what about, you know, the guy who lives out in Wagga and the guy who's, you know, up in, God knows, Ipswich. Is that going to resonate with him? But, I mean, it's, someone's got to lead the way. And I honestly think people will get over that if they... You're going to win probably more customers by doing that than trying to retain customers who may love you one week and may hate you the next. I actually think by being brave and doing that, you'll win more, you know, more hearts and minds probably.
Yeah. Do you remember the Honey Crunch? I think it was Honey Crunch, the This Is Wholesome stuff from the States a couple of years ago.
I forget the name of it. I know the campaign, This Is Wholesome, and it got all that flack from Americans going, that's not wholesome. What are you talking about? Gay people in ads and all that kind of stuff.
So good, though. They just embraced it and they just lent into it, didn't they? And
completely,
they're going to do it.
Yeah. That's the way it should be. And sure, they're getting flack for it, but a lot more people are aware of their brand now and probably buy into it.
Yeah. All right, mate. We're gonna wrap up, but before we do that, we've touched on the fact we've got kids. We've both got kids, so there's been long career that you've had there. Some working with some legends, bringing up two teenage kids, working at some great agencies. I say this to all the guests: it's pretty hard. How can we boil that down? All of those learnings and that experience down into, I don't know, whether it's a life lesson or something that you've learned that we can take away, that listeners can take away from all
of
that.
Oh, God, now you put me on the spot. Look, maybe this is a cop-out, but again, you know, have fun.
in advertising. Like, it's not, it's, you know, we get in a panic all the time about what we're doing and
who taking it too seriously.
Taking it way too seriously. And I think, you know, if we can have fun and get the clients on board with that as well and teach them to take it a bit less seriously too and realise that the pathway to great work is through, you know, working together and actually, you know, being honest with one another, because I think that doesn't happen enough, then, you know, there's the potential to do some great work. That's kind of my two cents.
Good. Thanks, mate.
Okay. No worries.
Thank you for coming on.
No, thanks for having me.
Cheers.
It's been fun. Hey!
Okay, thanks again to Will. Thank you to you for listening, and thank you to the guys at Smith & Weston for pulling this together. Dan and Nick here are absolute legends in sound. From creating original music tracks, stings and sound effects, to recording VOs, radio commercials and podcasts. They're master craftsmen, an absolute joy to work with, and genuine supporters of positive steps in the industry. So please keep them in mind for all your sound requirements. Thanks again. Until next time.